Walter Artibani was delayed by some pressing clinical case on his way to the airport, so went back to the hospital. And Marcus Drake, who is probably still outside preparing his slides. He's just come in on his bicycle. You weren't doing it while you were driving, were you?
No.
So Marcus has kindly agreed to deputise for Walter. Tony and Marcus.
Marcus got the phone call from hell last night as he was babysitting, saying, can you fill in, which he valiantly has done. So, can we get the slides up, please? What I thought we could best do on this, bearing in mind I think it's mainly about discussion and trying to work out some structure to how we assess and then how we treat patients whose sling has failed. Am I supposed to do this?
Right.
Oops, sorry. Okay. So, firstly, to address what we're actually talking about, what type of slings. It seemed to me that since the vast majority of slings that have been done are the so-called mid-urethral tapes or slings, that that's what we should focus on. What is failure? We've had quite a lot of discussion about what is failure, and I guess that we've got to bear that in mind in assessing what has been studied so far. And this is another example of to illustrate that your measure of failure will influence what your cure rate is, and this is from the recently published study comparing transobturator and TVT slings, showing that stress test, pad test, whatever you use will produce different outcomes. What I hadn't planned to cover, but we may want to bring out in discussion, is prediction of failure. There is a bit in the literature, particularly in relation to ISD and outcomes, and also a bit on voiding dysfunction, predicting voiding dysfunction. So we can discuss that if you like, but I hadn't really planned to cover it. In terms of what people are doing, Jonathan Duckett kindly provided this information from the British Society of Urogyny database, collected between 2007 and 10. Along the top line, you'll see over 300 cases in which the primary procedure, in black, the primary procedure had failed. And this is what people are doing and have entered onto the database. And these are just people who chose to enter their stuff onto the database. So 148 TVTs have failed. 54 of them have had a second TVT done, 32 TVTO, TOT, so quite a range. And I think what it illustrates is probably a second TVT is the commonest thing that people are doing, but there's quite a mishmash, and you know, people are using their own selection material criteria according to their own preferences, and I suspect there's quite a lot of that in all of our practices. And hopefully that's something we can discuss. But this is in the UK, there's obviously quite a variation. I haven't yet seen a clear definition of how we define failure as opposed to recurrence. Is it 6 months after, 1 month after? I guess it's fairly easy to say that if somebody is immediately they go home, they cough and they leak, that's a failure. But if somebody a month afterwards first starts experiencing stress and incontinence, is that failure or is that recurrence? And that's something perhaps we could try and bring some clarity to. Different types of failure, simply that the stress incontinence is still there with no other symptoms, and then you can get failure to cure stress incontinence, but there are new symptoms, be it of overactive bladder symptoms or voiding dysfunction, that the stress incontinence is cured, but there are other new symptoms that may arguably cause more problems than the stress incontinence, and that there are the new symptoms from complications from mesh erosions and whatever. So it may be valuable to categorize failure. And I think one of the key issues I think would be helpful to come out of this session is whether we should have a formal structured protocol pathway in modern parlance of assessing patients whose sling has failed, so that they'll all have a series of tests, and then we work through about different treatment protocols. And can we agree on an assessment pathway today? So what I'm planning to do is run through a few of the things that we might do in assessment and treatment, and then Marcus is going to present how he would assess patients whose sling has failed, and then we can shoot him down as we feel appropriate. Or support him, indeed. So I think it's pretty obvious we'll ask them about their symptoms, and in particular we'll ask them, are there any new symptoms, any OAB symptoms, avoiding dysfunction. Examination, how far should we go in looking for erosions? How important are erosions? It seems that some women can have erosions present and not even be aware of them, and then for others it becomes a big issue, and certainly even for their partner it can become a big issue. This is the sort of thing you sometimes see in a woman after a TBT. And I have to say that for whatever reason J&J did dye their tapes, it does make them a lot easier to pick out than the translucent tapes. This is a more complex issue, a case that was referred in to us where, sorry, the slide isn't perfect, you can see that the mesh hasn't actually fully, this is a TBT, hasn't quite eroded through, but there's quite a lot of evidence of inflammatory changes in the bladder. And quite what to do with that. This lady's acting main symptoms were of not being able to empty her bladder rather than of pain. Urodynamics, the role of urodynamics, should everybody have urodynamics, whether their procedures, whether they symptomatically have got other symptoms apart from stress incontinence, and what's the value of tests for intrinsic sphincter deficiency. I think that's a long debate, and indeed of course voiding studies. We've had quite a bit of discussion about urethral mobility. Should we be trying to categorise patients as being hypermobile or not? And if so, how do you do it? And there are lots of different methods available to us now, and we've had an interesting critique on the use of ultrasound. We did an interesting in-department blinded study comparing eyeball and ultrasound assessment. And rather remarkably, the ultrasound and eyeball testing were almost in complete accordance. For me it was particularly remarkable because the person doing the ultrasound assessment was my wife, and I think it's about the only thing we've ever agreed on clinically. So we were blinded. Maybe that's the way we should approach our marriage. So one of the areas though I think you do get from ultrasound, whether or not you attach great credence to the mobility of the urethra, is the position of the tape. And sometimes, and I have to accept, we're not scanning women who have had a successful outcome from their tape procedure, but the position of the tape in women who have failed varies from underneath the trigone to underneath the distal urethra. So how important that is, we really don't quite know. Stefano Salvatore, and in collaboration with King's, has an electronic device for measuring urethral vesicle mobility, and that may perhaps give a more consistent value to the mobility. But as I say, we've still got to establish, do we believe that seeing whether the urethra is mobile after tapes, are we sure that that is an important assessment? So from my point of view, what we're looking for on ultrasound assessment, which is something we have in the department, so it's easy to use and relatively cheap, and therefore, and that we've got the scanner available, is where the tape is along the urethra, how much support it's offering, the proximity to urethral lumen. There's some evidence from some studies that show that if it's very close to the urethral lumen, that you're more likely to get OAB symptoms. And also the configuration of the tape underneath the urethra, that if it's C-shaped under strain and flat at rest, may be an important valuation. That's been shown by, I think, Heinz Kobel's group. Is it Heinz's group or an Austrian group? Then on to the role of cystoscopy. In my experience, there's quite a lot of difference to the view that urologists take and gynecologists take on cystoscopy. There's a paper here from Craig Cometer, who is an associate professor in Tucson, Arizona. I don't know him other than that, but he makes the point that it's very important to do cystoscopy to look for ISD, and funneling of the proximal urethra is an important insight on cystoscopy. And here he describes, I'm sorry, it doesn't reproduce very well, it says, cystoscopic demonstration of intrinsic sphincter deficiency. So there is a view that the cystoscopy is useful for diagnosing intrinsic sphincter deficiency. But there are other issues about cystoscopy. Rigid or flexible, 0 degree, 30 degrees, 70 degrees. If you're looking for a taper inside the bladder, then many would believe that a 70 degree cystoscope is required. But of course, if you're looking for a taper along the urethra, then a 0 or 30 degree may be required. Is it mandatory that we use all before we say there is no evidence of any tape erosion? Bladder neck felling, is it relevant? Is it important? And identification of tapes that are close to the bladder without actually eroding through, are these important too? So, hypermobile, we're on to treatment options now. I've always taken the view, and I'd be interested to hear what Marcus has to say on this, that I would assess whether the patient's urethra appears to be mobile. To me, there doesn't seem a lot of logic in trying to support a urethra that isn't mobile. But okay, we can discuss that. So, what about the evidence for value of just repeating your TVT or TOT and risks and cases? This is quite a large series from a combination of Melbourne and an Israeli group. So they had 1,225 cases reviewed, of whom 955 were retropubic slings and 270 transobturator tapes. 77 of them were repeat slings. And what they demonstrated from this review was, and perhaps no great surprise, that repeat slings, they noted a lower cure rate, 86% versus 62%, that the TVT appeared to be more effective than the obturator tape, and somebody having, again, these are all repeat slings, and that in the women needing a second sling, they made a diagnosis of ISD more often, which I guess is not surprising. So whether that's the bigger influence or the fact that it's the second procedure is difficult to know. And interestingly, they noted higher rates of de novo urge and urge incontinence in the repeat surgeries. Now, whether that's just because they're having to put in something a bit tighter and that's compromising outflow and everything and producing the OAB symptoms is something we could debate. Here's another smaller study, 29 cases. 13 out of the 13 who had TBT, 12 were cured and 16, 10 cured. I think basically the size of this study that has been published demonstrates the big difficulty in this area is people don't generally have large numbers of failed slings, fortunately. And so it seems to me, in a research issue, we are going to need multi-center studies to look at the failures and trying to learn what we can from them. And if we're going to do multi-center studies, then we're going to have a structure in how we investigate and categorize the different failures. Colpus suspension, very little in the literature about colpus suspension after TVT. There's a small series from Chris Maher's group showing 16 cases did okay, although he did comment that some of them had quite a lot of fibrosis in the retropubic space. Very little on rectus sheath slings, although they obviously are being done, and indeed bulking agents. Plication of a previous sling was an interesting topic that I've heard mentioned at meetings before, and there's a series from Taiwan, 14 patients, 3 to 14 months after TVT, was when they did the plication, all done under local anaesthesia, taking an average of 17 minutes to do it, and they found 10 out of 14 cured. Now that's actually a relatively straightforward thing to do. What do you think? Just a little procedure under local anaesthetic, and it seems to produce quite a good result, I would have thought. So it's something that probably should be explored a bit more. What about the adjustable sling? Well, we have the Spanish have studied this more than most, and Dr. Aranda, who's here with us, I'm sure would be happy to share our experience. But his series published in Urology and Urodynamics in EPUB format, reported on 125 women who had this inserted, 70 of whom were deemed to have ISD and 55 recurrent stress incontinence, and quite good long-term follow-up here, mean of 36 months, and they achieved an 87% cure rate on subjective and objective testing. And basically their he may like to present to us how they go about their program. It's a structured way of readjusting the adjustable sling, which I think is of some real interest. So 21 out of the 125 had further readjustments done along the way, and only one of them, of the 125, required the device to be removed. To me, that's always seemed to be one of the main issues of putting a something on the anterior abdominal wall, but it didn't seem to be the problem that we might have expected. And lastly, well, we've got most of those options for those who've got a well-supported urethra, very little evidence, and most of the studies that are the case series are presented do not differentiate between hypermobile and well-supported urethra. So that's a problem. We just don't know whether that categorization is helpful. So if I can now pass you over to Marcus to take you through how he would assess someone, and then we can see if we can agree on a structured assessment. Should we pointy thing is there.
Great.
Shall I find your presentation? Trying to put it onto the.
Yeah, I'll just run it from the disk first.
Do you think so?
Faster.
So I run it from.
Yeah, that is what I think.
Maybe you have to switch that on and off, otherwise it's staying on.
Right, so the sort of categories that Tony's mentioned, I've sort of modified slightly. First category that I would personally suggest would be the patient that comes back and says it's not made a difference. Now that, to my mind, includes those patients who still have stress urinary incontinence, or who have a separate issue, that they haven't really sort of drawn any specific distinction from their preoperative symptoms. So they've got storage symptoms, in effect. They've either got persistent or recurrent stress incontinence, or they've got overactive bladder symptoms. Then you've got a separate group who might well be categorized as failures, though technically speaking they may be continent, very well continent. In other words, they may have now developed voiding symptoms. And then another category in which we perhaps should have a particularly key focus would be those with surgical complications. For example, the abscesses or the erosions into the urethra. Now, in terms of the basic assessment, this is obviously a situation where you're going to be spending a long time with this individual patient. You need to absolutely re-establish a confident relationship with that person if it's somebody that you personally have treated previously, or if it's a patient that's been managed elsewhere, their faith in the medical profession might be a little bit marginal. So you're going to have to make sure that you're establishing a rapport, and in your evaluation, obviously you're starting with the history, and you're trying to determine if it's persistent, and you're going to try to categorize based on the symptoms whether it is stress incontinence, urgency, or a sort of worrying situation of dribbling. Could that be a chronically distended bladder that's overflowing? Could there be a fistula, God forbid? And then obviously you need to see whether they've got retention, if they're aware that their bladder's still full, and how are things evolving? Because quite often at the initial post-operative phase there may be substantial difficulty with peeing as a consequence of discomfort or the anaesthetic, but then as the situation adapts or recovers, voiding might improve over time. Then, urodynamic risk factors. Now, ideally, there will have been urodynamics before the initial take was placed. That's not always the case, because our guidance in the UK actually says that urodynamics is not essential if it's entirely characteristic stress incontinence with no complicating features like voiding symptoms or previous surgery. Most, you hope, will have had urodynamics, and then you can review the urodynamic trace to see if a risk factor was present, but it's arguable what constitutes a risk factor, as Tony's just said. But then you also want to evaluate surgical risk factors. If I've done the operation, I will run over in my mind was a feature of the operation that will give me anxiety, such as substantial bleeding or a technical issue. For example, when removing the bags off a TVT, has the tape become too tight? Of course, a hematoma might have formed following the operation, and one might anticipate that that will pull on the sling and potentially will tighten a sling, leading to difficulty voiding subsequently. Then, of course, you do need to decide on the bothersomeness to the patient. If they're not bothered, if they've got a bit of difficulty passing urine, but they're delighted that they're continent, you probably don't need to take it substantially further, depending on subsequent findings. So with your examination, you need to confirm that that person has indeed got incontinence. You need to make sure that the pelvic floor, you can examine that and feel for any distortion of the anterior vaginal wall, specifically looking for a kink in the urethra, or feeling whether the anterior vaginal wall has been dragged up behind the pubis. And I'll illustrate a couple of cases subsequently to this. You need, obviously, to see if there's hypermobility still present. And then I would say a dipstick urinalysis is important, because that will give you a hint as to whether there could be persistent UTI, or, more importantly, could there be an erosion. If there's completely pristine urine with no red blood cells, no white blood cells, the chance, I would say, of a proper erosion is relatively small. Then, urodynamics. I would suggest that the majority of cases are likely to need urodynamics. But I would also make the point that the situation is highly individual, so that some people, if it's an early presentation, if it's strongly suspicious that it's an obstruction, on physical examination you can feel a kink in the urethra, then urodynamics is probably not going to be that contributory. And then finally, conservative therapy may help you with your basic assessment of deciding what's going wrong, going on. And it may be that you feel in a position where antimuscarinics is a first-line measurement, which when they come back and report an improvement, you've nailed the problem on the head and don't need to take it further. Now here's an example of a urodynamic trace in a lady that's had stress urinary incontinence surgery in the form of a TVT. And she's come back complaining of persistent urinary incontinence. Now in Bristol, the way that we label our lines is at the top we have blue for bladder, red for rectum for abdominal pressure, green for the subtracted detrusor pressure, black for flow, and the orange is the filling volume. And what in this lady you can see, very obviously, is detrusor overactivity, clearly apparent, and incontinence occurs. Now this really is a plea for good quality urodynamics. Why? This does not give us the answer to the lady's problem. The reason that it doesn't is she's come to you and she has described stress incontinence. You've done urodynamics and you've found detrusor overactivity incontinence, but you have completely failed to get a sufficient volume into the bladder, and the number here is 17 mils of fluid in the bladder. Now, by definition, urodynamic stress incontinence cannot be diagnosed in the presence of an overactive detrusor contraction. Throughout, she's got an overactive detrusor contraction. So we have somehow to get rid of this detrusor overactivity before we can even begin to answer the key question that she came to us with: does she have urodynamic stress incontinence? Now the way that we would do that is to lie her supine. The hint is that she was filled in the seated position. When we lay this particular lady supine, the overactivity stabilized, and we were then able to get her to cough and strain, and this was the point at which she leaked. And just to point out that because she's supine, you've actually got to look at the urethra to find if she leaks, because she is of course not above her flow rate machine now. So the diagnosis for this lady is mixed urinary incontinence. if we'd just taken our first trace and seen detrusor overactivity in continence, we'd have confidently given her antimuscarinics, perhaps even botulinum, and she would have come back and said, I'm still incontinent. And that's not a happy lady, because she's already had persistent incontinence after first-line treatment. Now, another key group, as mentioned, is those with new-onset voiding symptoms. So, just to sort of reflect on the anatomical basis for voiding problems, first of all, occlusion. Any foreign body sat in the urethra is going to block it like a plug. That's a bit rare. But then, importantly, there will be issues such as compression or distortion. Here's an example of compression, and we'll see the trace urodynamics that goes with this in a sec. This is iatrogenic post-TVT urethral compression. Distortion, and as Tony said, finding the tape in a funny location on a transvaginal ultrasound does really point towards insight into mechanism. And so in this, taken from a paper by Zimmern, there's a bone-anchored sling which is distorting the bladder neck, and it's easy to envisage difficulty voiding after that. So here is a urodynamic study showing a voiding phase only. The bladder contracts fairly well. For some reason, the pelvic floor seems to be relaxing additionally, so you're getting quite a good detrusor contraction and a relatively poor flow. And then the associated picture we've just seen, as she started to void, you got good bladder neck opening and then an abrupt limitation of flow at this point and a poor stream. So you can feel confident about a diagnosis of bladder outlet obstruction there. This one is not so clear cut. And so what I would be keen to recommend is that video urodynamics is the way forward. This is another voiding phase with a lady with voiding difficulty after TVT. And here we can see that flow is clearly intermittent. And associated with that, you don't have that high pressure sustained detrusor contraction. You've got this wandering, poorly sustained detrusor contraction, though amplitude is fairly good. Now, given with that as a trace, as somebody that does a lot of neuro-urodynamics, I would say that we see this quite often in neurological patients in whom there are voiding symptoms, and we tend to describe this as a form of detrusor underactivity. Arguable, but with video urodynamics, and the trouble is that I haven't had time to link the video here, when we did this lady's video, we could see a very obvious hold up as she voided at this point. And we then felt substantially more confident that, in fact, it's not detrusor underactivity, it was obstruction. Now, just want to very quickly run through three cases. The first case is the common sort. In other words, when we examined her, we found that on vaginal examination, there was an obvious kink overlying the midpoint of the urethra. So she's had a sling in the past, everything seemed to be reasonably straightforward, but when she came back at 6 weeks, she described voiding dysfunction, physical examination revealed this, and we then proceeded to cut the tape, and as a subsequent follow-up, she was able to pass urine satisfactorily, and luckily was continent. So there's a few sort of publications, and there are more ongoing publications, to say that cutting the tape seems to be a good idea in many, that you don't want to leave it too long because of fibrosis and potentially the detrusor giving up the ghost. Here's another tape which describes four people having a tape sectioning, and rather disappointingly, three of them got a recurrence of stress urinary incontinence, from which the message has to be, don't just cut the tape and forget about the continence. There could be return of incontinence. And then finally, this study which pointed out that voiding symptoms are likely to improve in a well-selected tape sectioning patient, but storage symptoms will probably remain unchanged, and again pointing out incontinence may well return. Now, this is a different situation. This is a 50-year-old woman who seemed to have a very straightforward story for TVT placement. She had good urodynamic stress incontinence demonstration on urodynamics. TVT was entirely uncomplicated, yet when she came back, she was in complete retention and utterly unable to void. Saw her at 2 weeks and undertook a physical examination, and her anterior vaginal wall was entirely as it should have been. There was a bit of anterior descent, there was no kink whatsoever. So we then went over her past medical history, and what she'd forgotten to tell us was at the age of 40 she'd had a brainstem stroke giving her hemiplegia, from which she'd clearly made an excellent recovery, but she had got a major neurological history and almost certainly had compensated her detrusor function such that when she had a perturbation in the form of surgery, she found it impossible to pass urine. Because of this finding, we did not cut the tape, we sat it out, and subsequently voiding returned with no post-void residual. So then the final case was a lady who'd had a previous STAMI procedure and had then come back with persistent symptoms, was found to have probable intrinsic sphincter deficiency with urodynamic stress incontinence, and so had had an autologous sling placed, which had proved difficult. And what we'd found with her is that her pelvic floor was dragged right up behind the pubis. In effect, I think what had happened is that the knots on her autologous sling had dragged the anterior vaginal wall far too high up, and so she actually needed quite a difficult procedure, abdominal and perineal treatment, cutting the sling at its rectus muscle attachment so that this could drop down, and also cutting the sling in the perineum so that we could get her passing urine again. So, the final point to make is that there is a higher than recognized erosion rate. We had a lady last year who presented with a urethral erosion, and we clicked that she'd been in the UK and Ireland TVT trial. So we got in touch with Karen Ward and Paul Hilton and discussed this, and we were able to come to the conclusion that following that trial, there is an erosion rate currently at 9 years for this individual patient of 4% at least, because what we've not done is surveyed every individual patient. That's technically not going to be manageable, but we know of erosions in 4% of those patients, and that I think represents quite an alarming situation. Now, how are we going to deal with the urethral erosions? This is a particularly challenging situation, and it's one that we need to make sure that we factor in three key elements. Number one, if the tape's lying across the urethra, it's got to be removed. It can't be left in the lumen of the urinary tract. So tape removal is essential, and it's got to be removed and the holes, defects closed so that she doesn't subsequently develop a fistula. Number two, you've got to consider how are you going to ensure that the lady remains continent. And an autologous sling placed at the same time is something that we can usually undertake. But then finally, you need to bear in mind subsequent options have got to be kept open. So in other words, if she remains highly bothered with severe stress incontinence, even with this operation, you may need further surgery in the future. And one thing that we do is place omentum around the urethra, which ensures that we have got a track into which we could place potentially even an artificial urinary sphincter for future treatment if stress incontinence persists despite our sling placement. So that brings me to an end, apart from to sort of raise for discussion some of the research questions that Tony's mentioned and I've brought up a bit as well, and of course any other questions that crop up should be mentioned, please, as well.
Starting from the beginning, perhaps, do we feel we can formalize or have a structured assessment for the failed sling? I mean, do we feel there's a standard set of investigations that everybody should have or do you think it has to be tailored? Or combination, Linda?
I think you have to do a bit of both, really. And I've been badly caught out by not doing my own investigations and accepting the results of investigations that people have sent me. And we got one referral of a woman who'd failed a TVT, and he'd done video urodynamics, he'd done a cystoscopy, and I went and did a colposuspension because he was not particularly confident doing one after a failed sling, and she may have had something else as well. And it wasn't until post-operatively, when she went into retention and our nurse couldn't catheterize her, that we cystoscoped her and she'd got a tape straight through her urethra. And of course then, of course, we all felt absolutely dreadful, and then we took the tape out of the urethra, and then I had to repair her urethro-vaginal fistula, and it was an absolute disaster. And so now, anyone that comes onto my list because of a failed tape has to have had a history and examination by one of us, and a cystoscopy and video urodynamics done at King's before I'll do anything else.
Any? Peggy? At the top.
Two things that have been emerging as we see more and more failures of mid-urethral slings. One thing is that I see a lot of failures where the sling is under the trigone or under the bladder. And I think sometimes that one of the simplest things to do is just to measure the distance from the external meatus to where that sling's sitting in terms of understanding why it's not working. But more and more now we're requiring that you scope in clinic before taking a failed mid-urethral sling back, because there are so many patients who, well, there are four in the last year who I wasn't expecting that they had a sling erosion into their bladder or into their urethra, and it's just bad form to find it at the time of surgery. So cystoscopy is not part of our assessment of most patients with failed slings, but now it's become part of it if they've had a failed mesh sling.
So do we feel strongly enough about that to make that a recommendation?
Well, I certainly do.
Okay, well, we have two. Does anyone take a contrary view?
I would agree that all of them need a cystoscopy and BCMG. So I don't think you can make it, you can be fair to the patient if you don't do that, in my opinion.
So if we're trying to get, I'm conscious of trying to write this up. Are we saying that we would recommend all patients with a failed sling who've got symptoms should have a cystoscopy? Anyone take the contrary view?
It depends how you describe the failed sling. I think you guys described almost two different things. One is the sling that isn't doing what you wanted it to do, and one is the sling that's perhaps obstructing. So someone who has a TVT and voided perfectly the day before and is in retention the day after, I think I would suggest that you could probably get away, especially if it's your own patient, without urodynamics or cystoscopy if you're going to be bringing them back to the OR 2 to 3 weeks later. So I think we have to differentiate between what we mean by failed.
Well, so you're saying that you would be confident there was no erosion in those circumstances?
Well, I think that there's, if you did it yourself and you had scoped yourself.
We can all be caught out.
But I'm saying if the problem is obstruction, I mean, we don't scope every sling 2 weeks after, all the ones that worked fine. So why would a sling that had straightforward obstruction and had a normal urinalysis, that's 2 to 3 weeks later?
Right.
I mean, I think there's a lot of data that says the temporal sequence is good enough.
We're putting out recommendations, and they're effectively their guidelines, and guidelines, not tramlines. So we might say there are some exceptions to cases where you're confident. Okay, but in the main, I think we're saying that a cystoscopy is indicated for somebody with a failed sling.
It's fair to say, isn't it? It's probably underdiagnosed the sling erosions, and without question, you've got a high degree of suspicion if there is dipstick hematuria or storage symptoms.
And can we qualify that by what type of cystoscopy we do? Any views on that?
Quality.
Yep. I mean, obviously, a flexible cystoscopy copes with the angles. Right. We know from urology in general that a 30-degree telescope misses
events on the anterior wall of the bladder, which is exactly where you might have a sling erosion. So I think if you were doing rigid cystoscopy, you should do 0 for the urethra and 70 for the to make sure you've got every bit of the bladder.
And your
any divergence from that view? Because this is going to come out as a recommendation. So
One technical point that Paul sort of really introduced me to was the panendoscope. In other words, a standard cystoscope has quite a setback between the actual end of the cystoscope telescope and the emergence of the irrigation fluid, which means that the irrigation isn't really going to get into the urethra sufficiently effectively when you are doing the actual urethroscopy if you just use a completely standard cystoscope. So it's a one where the irrigation is actually able to come out from close to the end of the cystoscope. It gives you a really good evaluation of the urethra.
Okay. Can I just ask a question? Do we believe that you can see the urethra with a 30 degree? Paul, you said 0 degree. Do you think you can adequately see the urethra with a 30 degree? Because I'm conscious that there is often litigation around these sort of cases, and anything we state as recommendation might be sort of thrown back, so we should be careful with what our...
Well, I think it's just a principle. Why would you endoscope a tube with anything other than a forward-looking instrument? I mean, it's just basic physics, isn't it? Now, if you haven't got a zero-degree telescope, you probably shouldn't be doing urogynecology. But if somebody dropped it on the floor and trod on it, I mean, most times, of course, you get away with a 30.
But you're trying to look at the wall of the tube. So some manufacturers make 12-degree scopes, and I think that's okay. Probably the ideal. But that's not to say go shopping for 0 and 30 degrees if all you've got is a...
Right. Okay. Thank you. There's another question about you.
Well, Robert van Koeveringen from Maastricht. My experience is that with the flexible cystoscope, you have a far better view of the urethra, and you really tend to miss also because of the end of your cystoscope being rigid. You tend to miss urethral lesions, especially in the front. I had it sometimes that it was missed before.
Thank you.
Surely the answer between rigid and flexible is to use whatever you're happiest using and what right. You use most of the time.
I mean, he makes a good point that you don't get flow through a flexible. And I think
how much you're making a good point, because you don't get... I mean, we would in this case always put the patient to sleep, basically, and do our cystoscopy rather than try and do it as a flexi. And with a flexi, you don't get the flow through the scope to blow the walls of the urethra apart, which is the point of the panendoscope as opposed to the beak cystoscope. So in terms of best view, if you're interested in that, then I think a panendoscope gives the best view. I mean, you don't have to put the patient to sleep, of course, to do a panendoscopy in most women if they're slightly brave.
And you don't need to put them to sleep to do a rigid cystoscopy. We don't use any flexible yet. Most of our cystoscopy, yeah, that's how we're going. I mean, is this something that we need further research on, or are we sufficiently competent in our expert opinions?
Expert opinion.
Okay, so it's... Yeah, so it's not a research topic. It's something we can reasonably put down some statements or recommendations. Okay, thank you. One of the things that we brought out that strikes me as certainly as a research topic was the role of physiotherapy. On the BSOG database, about a third of the women who have been treated for a failed sling are referred for physio. Now, I don't think there's much research, or if any, done on failed slings, the value of pelvic floor physiotherapy. I'm looking for help on this. Is there any work done on failed slings, physiotherapy for failed slings?
Nothing that I know of.
So, I mean, that's an area that we need to know. Should we be sending them? Because a third of them are being sent. Is it a waste of time? Is it something you should be doing? Or a research topic?
Yeah. I think it's a research topic, of course.
Okay, thank you.
It kind of depends as well, though, whether they've had physio before. You know, whether they've already had failed physiotherapy.
Well, except that the second you've changed, that you may well have changed the anatomy by your sling,
yeah.
And it may be that you've now brought it up enough for physio to... or conjecture. Paul?
No, just exactly that point, really. I mean, I cannot see that anything you do at the time of a TVT or any other operation is going to make physiotherapy more effective. I may be wrong in that presumption, but I suspect that those 30% who were sent for physio after their tapes are 30% who didn't have physio before. And if that's the case, then you have to say they've been done a disservice by having their operation.
Okay.
Two disservices.
Right, thank you. We've got 5 minutes to go. Can I
just say, sorry, about the role of physio in post-sling in terms of voiding dysfunction more than failed incontinence, and some of dysfunctional voiding we find beneficial in having physiotherapy work in terms of improved voiding.
Interesting point.
Pelvic floor relaxation rather than improving tone of contraction.
Interesting point. Another research point for you. Can I? Sorry.
So we were just wondering if there's any data on duloxetine failed slings for those of us in Europe.
I haven't seen any. Has anyone else got anything on that? No. What about imaging in terms of? We've heard the view on mobility and the lack of value. Do we value imaging in terms of tape position, and what is the best modality to use? Is VCU better than ultrasound? Do we have any views on that?
Well, if you use ultrasound, at least you can look at the tape. Any other modality, you can't see the tape.
Right.
And at least for those who are obstructed by the sling, at least you can see that usually the sling is in an abnormal position.
So, but I'm trying to think, supposing we were doing a study of failed slings, a multi-center study, should we include an ultrasound assessment of where the tape is? Because we could learn a lot more about what produces failure.
But the problem with a number of the questions that you gave is what you mean by failed sling. You know, if you put together retention versus incontinence recurrence versus erosion, you know, these are three different animals.
Yeah.
You know, you can't even have the same diagnostic procedure or algorithm.
Except you could, for all we know, I mean, we were talking about having the tape underneath the trigone and number. Well, that may happen in lots of people who have cured, for all we know. And I suppose, it's a question at the back. Yeah.
I do vaginal ultrasound regularly in failed sling, and you can very easily determine where your sling is. For example, there are some cases in which the sling lies too low and is in mainly in obese women is put underneath instead of over the ischiac bone, and you can discover those cases and also the position of the sling in the longitudinal area. And then you do a redo of the sling, and it's cured.
Okay.
I would advocate it.
Thank you. Any other, Karis?
I would agree that when you're writing this up, you should definitely separate it out into what bit of failure you're talking about. Is it recurrence of incontinence, complications, and retention? But could you also include a list of possible treatments for recurrence of incontinence? You've said repeat operation. One you haven't mentioned is, for example, the pessary that's got a sort of bump on it,
yeah.
You know, a sort of conservative management like that. So all the alternative possible managements that you could have for failed slings.
Thank you.
I wonder if you just asked for a head count of those of us in the room who do surgery, what we would do after several of these scenarios, because the most common thing is a failed midurethral sling, a meshed midurethral sling. Another common scenario is a midurethral sling that's out of position. And it just would be interesting to see right now if other people put in another mesh sling, or you showed those data at the beginning, but within the room of those of us who do surgery.
We have to assume. We've got about a minute left, have we?
You do, yeah.
We do want the aerodynamics, do we?
Well, on your list.
Sorry. Yes, on this. I just thinking we're running fast out of time, unfortunately. Should we? Yes, no answers. Can we have who would do a repeat TVT on a failed TVT?
You're doing the aerodynamics first, then.
It's like having a backseat driver, isn't it?
Well, I'm reading your slide.
You're reading my slide.
It's his slide. I have not seen this slide before. Right. What do you want to do? You want to do some aerodynamics? Have you got some aerodynamics?
No, oh, no, we're coming.
Okay, yeah. Sorry. Do we all want to do aerodynamics? Yeah, okay. So aerodynamics is mandatory, even if it's just simple stress incontinence?
Yeah.
Right, okay, so that's a recommendation. No, we're just saying, the first thing is simple stress incontinence. In other words, the symptoms haven't changed. Are we going to do aerodynamics again? Yeah?
Why? Yeah, we got
that. If you don't suspect underlying detrusor overactivity, why would you repeat aerodynamics if you already had stress incontinence? What? To find out that she had ISD and you didn't diagnose it the first time?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Well, it's a tough situation to have an operation that you've done that didn't work, and then you do another operation, and if that doesn't work, you have got a pretty hard case to argue with an unhappy person.
You'll have to tell me about your experience with that, Marcus. I've never actually had that happen.
I've never had that experience because I check out.
Well, the consensus seems to be we do aerodynamics. The question mark about how much value it is if the symptoms haven't changed at all, although the argument's been put that maybe you pick up ISD, would you manage those differently? Well, perhaps we'll come on. Systometry, yes. Looking for ISD. So people are still doing tests, urethral function tests, and value those. And would that influence their treatment?
Yes.
Right. I think there's sort of people making noise at the front. Is that a general agreement? Would people yes. go along with that? Yes.
It's
apparent.
The other question is, if you had done the first sling, would you put in a second, same sling?
Yeah. Okay.
That's different from somebody else cocking up the first sling and you doing it second.
Well, it depends on what your assessment is based on. If you do it on if the urethra is mobile afterwards, it's mobile whether you put it in or anybody else put it in. And that's why I think we should be trying to structure our assessment, not just saying, sunny outside, do a fancy another sling, or I haven't done Aldridge for a while, that's a nice idea. We should be trying to do it in a structured way so that then we can analyse crisply the results rather than just producing case series afterwards. And So I would have thought surely it's about not who did the sling before, but is the urethra mobile or not? Is there ISD or not?
Yes. Don't call me Shirley.
Are people happy with that? I've got to put some recommendations here. I need some help.
Yeah.
Are we happy with that approach? So we go to look for mobility, whoever's done the sling before, and we look for ISD. Now, having done that, what modifications? Do we just put a TVT in if it's mobile, whether or not there's ISD? Right. Is that mainly just to keep your skills in other operations up, or is there a justification for that?
Tony, isn't that the stage when you discuss it with the patient?
Right.
Because patients have different preferences as well. And
yeah.
Some patients, when you put it to them, that a second sling may have a lower success rate than a first one would, but is less invasive than doing a colpo suspension or whatever
yeah.
other thing you do, the patient has to make that decision with you. I mean, I tend to sort of prefer a colpo suspension if someone's had a failed sling. I think it's silly to do the same operation twice, but some patients don't go for that, and also some patients definitely prefer an injectable.
Right. Okay. Any other thoughts on that? But we could do with some data on this, couldn't we? Not that that should interfere with our treatment.
I think the injectable is a good idea, and there should be a trial based on that, because it's minimally invasive. If you use something like collagen, there's no harm to the patient. It may well fail, but you've got an indication then of whether repeat stress incontinence surgery in the conventional sense will work.
Okay.
You've still got to decide which it will be, of course.
Okay. Can we have the back? Yeah?
Just a comment. I mean, we surveyed 20 urologists and 20 gynecologists in the UK with similar questions. And the first question was whether they failed it. If they failed the TVT and they've had urodynamics, standard urodynamics, how would a urologist or a gynecologist? And these are experts, urologists and gynecologists. And what we found is about 40% would want more invasive urodynamics or more invasive tests such as 4D ultrasound or advanced urodynamics. But out of the 50% who actually replied, and what they would do is about half of them would actually do a TVT again. A quarter would do a colpo, and a quarter would do a rectus sheath sling. And then we asked what would happen if that fails again, so a third, a second failure. And there were different views of on things like doing another artificial sphincter or bladder neck closure or injectables. And then we asked about the failure of if patients go into retention. Most of them would actually just keep the catheter in or treat them conservatively. But one of the other options is to do a pull down at about 3 days or 7 days of the failed sling. And that seems okay. to be also a thing
well,
that's practiced.
We're looking forward to seeing that in print. Thanks for that. Have we got to finish, Paul?
Yes. Right. We've got a lot to do after tea. We need to have a very fast tea break because we've got quite a lot after tea.
Well, thank you very much for your contribution. We'll try and put it together.
Got some words in there. Yeah, that's a real poison chalice.